Some of the circumstances that have led to tonight's event are worth recounting. Last summer, about a month after my Newman essay came out, I came across Eva's excellent article. It's fair to say that I was jealous. Not only had we written about the same artist, but about some of the same artworks, and in particular about this anomalous painting, The Wild. And I thought she had written so much better than I had. I soon discovered that three other scholars had taken this thin canvas from 1950 as the starting point for essays that came out about the same time as had mine and Eva's. I thought it was strange that five academic articles appeared nearly simultaneously about one of the strangest works to be painted at mid-century. Or perhaps it's just Newman scholars who are strange. But I found myself dissatisfied, with one exception, by those other accounts. It was Eva's point of view that seemed right to me, not just because it overlapped with my own, but because she had argued it creatively and persuasively. And so I thought I'd write to her. It turned out that she and a colleague would be traveling across the United States later that summer. The colleague is in the audience. Less than a month passed before I found myself sitting across from her at a cafe in Austin, Texas. During dinner, I think we briefly mentioned the possibility of seeing each other in Europe. Now here we are, talking again with one another and talking with you, and I couldn't be more grateful to the Terra Foundation for allowing us the opportunity to do so. And I'm especially grateful to Jennifer and Virla and the staff here for helping arrange things both here and in Berlin. What I thought I'd do is say a little bit about what I take Eva's argument to be and to follow that with a few comments about some of the consequences I understand her position to entail. I'd then like to talk about some more recent thoughts I've had about Newman. Eva and I start with essentially the same insight and aim to solve a similar problem. In the scholarship on Newman's art, there is often a kind of one-to-one conjunction made between his pronouncements about his paintings and the content of those paintings, which is to say that art historians tend to use his statements as evidence of what his paintings mean. In so doing, they take Newman at his word, which is not surprising since Newman was articulate, precise, and very charming. I take him at his word. But I recognized, as did Eva, that a critical interpretation of the meaning of Newman's works needed to proceed by temporarily detaching his testimony from a formal analysis of the paintings themselves. It might well turn out that Newman was right about his content, but using his statements as evidence would have to be secondary to developing an account of how, by what technical means, and through what pictorial effects he communicated that content to his viewers. The title of the painting I'm showing you now is Vir Heroicus Sublimus, which translates roughly as Man Heroic and Sublime. If Newman weren't so serious about his convictions, I'd think the title was pretentious. But the hyperbolic never seemed like it was a joke to him. He really believed that people could become heroic or sublime in relation to each other, and despite what to Newman was a terrifying and inauspicious historical moment. Eva's argument, if I may summarize it, is that Newman adopted the rhetoric of the sublime as a way to counter the charge that his abstract paintings were merely formal. Newman accused most abstract artists, including Mondrian, of playing games with pictorial elements, line, color, shape, setting those elements into dynamic tensions or strategically balancing them to create a sense of formal closure or unity. Newman charged that such formalists treated aesthetics as a science, as a set of rules, and thereby denied to artists their rightful claim to spontaneity. Not surprisingly, he opposed formalism to his way of working, which perhaps despite appearances, he considered intuitive, original, and unpredictable. In By Twos, for instance, we perceive the resolution of a displaced symmetry without needing to verify that impression with actual measurements, even though the painting's title, with its suggestion of counting by twos, might prompt us to think that some mathematical progression determines the composition. In fact, none does. The intuition of symmetry is faster and more immediately convincing than its verification, just as, perhaps, is the intuition of truth. For as some scholars have suggested, by twos, the title, might refer to Noah's counting of the animals of the ark in response to God's command. Eva latches onto one of Newman's preferred terms, the sublime, in order to explain that at least part of the content of his art has to do with the way it solicits from a viewer a, quote, heightened level of self-awareness. I'll admit that I've always been embarrassed by the rhetoric of the sublime, insofar as it has been applied to abstract expressionism. It reminds me of the unconvincing equation some scholars draw between New York school artists and the European Northern Romantic tradition. But Eva makes the connection more convincing to me by explaining how the sublime, at least in the Kantian tradition, is associated with a kind of triumph of cognition over its potential loss in the face of nature's overwhelming expansiveness and power. That affirmation of the self against the vastness of space and time concerned Newman at a fundamental level. Eva quotes Newman to that effect, who, after visiting some Native American burial grounds in Ohio, associated his experience of that space with a sense of self-awareness. As Eva puts it, the content of Newman's art is tied to his painting's capacity to make the viewer, quote, aware of his mode of perception, its capacities, and its limitations. This, in turn, leads them to apprehend their own existence in relation to this very artwork, end quote. With the concept of the sublime, she continues, Newman designates, quote, the specific aesthetic experience he intends to activate with his artworks and ascribes meaning to the viewer's response. It's the status of that response that concerns me, too. Here we have the terms that are undoubtedly the right ones in approaching Newman: intention, perception, experience, response, and self-awareness. Eva offers a compelling interpretation of just how the pictorial effects of Newman's art solicit the viewer's awareness of her perceptual act. She focuses on those that are related to the indeterminacy of figure and ground, and those that depend on the ambivalence between the literal flatness of the canvas surface and the suggestions of illusionistic depth beyond. The art historian Evelyn Bois, who made a similar argument about Newman in light of Maurice Merleau-Ponty's Phenomenology of Perception, shares that view. Bois affirmed Newman's capacity not just to represent, but to deliver something like original perception, as if the painting created an immersive environment within which the viewer experienced her own origin as subject. But Eva makes, to my mind, the more critical observation, namely that to Newman, the viewer's self-reflexive awareness of perceiving, of catching herself, as it were, in the act of perception, establishes a distance between herself and the painting, which is to say that Newman's intent in creating a painting that challenges the viewer's perception in a way that makes the viewer both aware of the challenge as well as aware of his role in meeting the challenge is to differentiate the viewer and the painting. This is important, I think, because only when the painting and its meaning are distinguished from the viewer and his contingent experiences are we in a position to interpret pictorial content. That difference or separateness is the main theme of my essay. Before we get to it, though, let me point out that a lot of Newman criticism centers around overcoming separateness, of de-differentiating the painter, the painting, and the viewer. I never tire of quoting Peter Schlesdahl of The New Yorker, who wrote that vir heroicus sublimus, quote, invades and displaces our sense of ourselves, and the effect is a brief but intense experience that begs to be called the sublime, loss of selfhood to something bigger and nobler than we are. It sounds like we are meant to embrace this loss of self, but as I've argued elsewhere, I see the fantasy that Newman's canvases obliterate the divide between viewer and painting as a kind of evasion or avoidance of interpreting it. To the degree that we maintain a sense of the work's independence from us, we maintain a sense of our separate selves in relation to it. That is the condition of our access to the work's meaning, and the condition of our coming to understand the expression, Newman's expression. It is paradoxically the source of our connection. As viewers, we face a painting that does not open itself to us as if automatically. It must instead be interpreted. Yet hostility to interpretation is currently fueling the advance of a number of approaches in the humanities. Eva glosses one in her footnotes, and I found it so interesting that I'd like to bring it to the forefront of discussion. It is what we might call the aesthetics of affect, with an A. Briefly, affect theory emerged in the 1990s from a set of dissatisfactions with dominant modes of analysis in the humanities. At that time, some scholars began to feel that certain central facts about human experience, specifically those that did not rise or fall to the level of signification, were being ignored in favor of a constructionist view of the subject. If most academics at the time were stressing the way that language and discourse determined human subjectivity, a small group turned to precognitive modes of awareness that were felt to be even more basic, even more imperative than discourse. In recent years, the impetus to describe such precognitive modes has taken a scientific turn. The aesthetics of affect is increasingly advanced under the banner of neuro-art history, which equates meaning with physiological response, psychophysiological response. But whether scientific or not, what most interests affect theorists is the actual response of the reader or the viewer to an art object. In other words, affect theory renders the concept of the work of art as the expression of an artist's intentions, that is, as an expression that needs to be interpreted, irrelevant. Affect theory, in fact, informs some approaches to Newman, although they don't immediately look like affect theory. Eva brought to my attention two philosophers, Gernot Böhm and Dieter Mersch, who both follow Jean-Francois Lyotard in asserting that Newman's works function in, quote, the blink of an eye. The phrase is Lyotard's. Like a, quote, lightning bolt. They are, quote, triggers for an epiphany. Listen to what Mersch writes. Newman's objects, which can be called neither paintings nor sculptures, constitute no artworks, no media. Within them, the event itself, which is erratic as well as ecstatic, becomes manifest. The event seems to transcend mediation. It is ecstatic, beyond or outside representation. Something in Mersch's quote suggests a moment independent of language, discourse, power, culture, that is outside, beyond, or underneath media and the forces that numerous thinkers have argued constitute our reality and determine our subjectivities. And if that is more or less a correct identification of Mersch's motivation, then he's not so different than a host of other thinkers who turn towards affect as something that operates beyond signification, outside of determination. Affect, that is, transcends meaning, properly understood. When Mersch says that Newman's art is a trigger for an epiphany, he treats the work as a mere object, as a stimulus for a reflex. It's as if he's combined the scientific jargon of neuro-art history, trigger, with that of metaphysics, epiphany. Slide, please. I can't imagine a position more alien to the spirit of Newman's work. He resisted the false dichotomy of feeling and meaning. In her article, Eva chose a wonderful quote to illustrate the point. Explaining why he gives titles rather than numbers to his works, Newman expressed that he wanted to, quote, create metaphors that will in some way correspond to what I think is the feeling in them and to the meaning of it. Listen again. To what I think is the feeling in them and to the meaning of that feeling. The moment of cognitive appraisal Newman identifies contrasts sharply with the ecstatic epiphany of Mersch's event. And it seems to me that the best way to articulate that appraisal is through formal analysis. When I look at Concord, it doesn't trigger an epiphany. But I do have the impression that Newman has achieved, through subtle technical means, the concord or wholeness to which his title refers. So how does he do it? Observe that the two canvas-colored bands that establish a braced center in the aqua-green field are not, in fact, bare reserves of canvas. Rather, they are 3-inch strips of masking tape, the edges of which have sufficiently obstructed Newman's loose brushing of the surrounding field to gather residues of paint along their lengths. That procedure creates lines that now appear as if they were drawn in order to delineate the edges of the bands. Although the inconstant linearity might come across as a chance effect, Newman, in fact, controlled it. Always expert with his materials, he knew, of course, both the adhesion strength of the tape that he was using and its absorptive qualities. By varying the amount of pressure he applied to the tape, he could manipulate the tightness of its bond to the canvas and thus could anticipate the degree to which excess paint from his brush would bleed under and be deposited along its length. In fact, it's likely that Newman carefully prepared just those surface conditions that would cause the lines to modulate in the way that they have in intensity and clarity as he, you know, drew them by brushing across the ridges of the bands. The spontaneous emergence of line from the procedural application of painterly color overcomes the traditional opposition of the terms in a special way. It is as if each of those pictorial elements were motivated into existence by the other in such a way that the contingency of their relation is utterly defeated. They bring each other to life, as Newman once said of his fields and bands. I tend to think that Newman's effort to eliminate any sense of contingency from the relations he produces is meant to affirm the totality of the painting. The sheer rightness of those relations, as Michael Fried put it, establishes the painting's independence or autonomy as a work of art from the contingent experiences of its viewers. I almost hate to mention the fact that the title Concord refers to a town involved in the American War of Independence. It's also the birthplace of the great writer of American self-sufficiency and autonomy, Henry David Thoreau, the town where Newman and his wife went on their honeymoon. When I reflect on Newman's promise of shared, intelligible, pictorial meaning, I feel a kind of poignancy. That's an affective response to my interpretation of his meaning. That's not quite the same thing as saying that I was stimulated to feel poignancy by looking at the painting itself. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that poignancy is the exact feeling Newman intended to convey or even produce in his viewers. Indeed, in my active interpretation, I'd claim that poignancy is part of Newman's content. But I'd also insist that even if a viewer did not feel such poignancy at the very moment she was looking at Newman's canvas, she would still be able to understand the painting. Why? Because the painting's meaning is utterly independent of the actual affective experience it affords any particular viewer. Had I experienced a different emotion, let's say jealousy, I would be no less able to interpret the painting than I am when I experience poignancy. That's because my feelings of poignancy, like my possible feelings of jealousy or any other feeling I might contingently have, are utterly irrelevant to Newman's meaning. My feelings might make me more perspicuous about his intentions, but the meaning of his art is not to be found in my affective responses to it. My feelings don't add to the meaning of Newman's art. That meaning is already there, fixed and determined by the artist. Interpretation entails making claims about what we think those intentions are in an effort to render his meaning intelligible, objective, and shareable. Here's a gesture towards a conclusion. I've recently become interested in photographs in which Newman identifies himself with his zips, as if to insist on his presence in them. Here he is in his studio in 1951, subtly positioned so that the right framing edge of by twos, which I showed you earlier, becomes a zip that carries through the bridge of his nose, his Windsor knot, and his button jacket. Here he is in 1951, again, at this Betty Parsons show, photographed by Hans Nemeth. It's funny. You know, the corner of the entrance divides Newman like one of his zips. The year before that, Nemeth had been more technical, creating a double exposure that united Newman's ghost images with the bands of Vir Heroica Sublimis. And finally, number four. And here's Aaron Siskind's 1950 portrait, which may have been just a mistake, but I like the way that the edge of the door, the double exposure of the door behind Newman, creates a zip of that pairs with the other verticals to his side. Those pictures remind me of a great story one of the artist's best critics, Thomas Hess, told about Newman. This is the story that Hess wrote about. There used to be a game played in the Cedar Tavern, he said. The rule was that every painting is a self-portrait. The game was to find a way to describe each painter's self-portrait. And the key question was, what's Newman's self-portrait like? The prize answer was, Barney's walking into an elevator, and just a split second before the doors close, he turns around and looks at you. Acknowledging the separateness of that look entails acknowledging your separateness. That might make you more aware of the conditions of meaning, his and yours. It might be an uncomfortable experience. Once, a visitor to Newman's show, a fellow painter, began swearing and calling Newman names. Newman asked him why he was so upset. The man replied that Newman's work was making him aware of himself, and he did not like it.